Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive.
Today we are attempting to deconstruct one of the most recognizable yet maybe misunderstood figures in all of modern literature, Franz Kafka. If I say his name, you instantly think of, well, the tortured writer, right? Existential despair. And of course that word, Kafkaesque.
Kafkaesque. It's incredibly potent shorthand, isn't it? It describes those nightmare situations, the absurd, logic-defying, soul-crushing encounters with vast, indifferent power structures. It's where I think the average person's understanding of Kafka often begins and maybe ends.
Exactly. And it often leaves us with this mental image of Kafka himself, this neurotic, isolated genius who wrote his miserable stories from, like, a dark corner of Prague, totally detached from the world. What if that entire popular perception, you know, the one based on all the angst, what if it was fundamentally wrong? That is precisely the challenge taken up by the scholarship we're diving into today. Our sources aim to, well, dismantle the myth, really, and reveal the real Kafka, someone who is actually a highly integrated, sophisticated social critic, whose works are rooted in the specific turbulent historical and political reality of early 20th century Prague. It's a complete, well, a paradigm shift for how we read him.
Okay, so where does this new perspective mainly come from?
The primary source for this deep dive stems from the work of Richie Robertson. He's the Taylor Professor of German Language and Literature at Oxford, and he is a leading authority on Central European literary culture, particularly the late Habsburg period. So he really knows the context.
Right, his academic pedigree is obviously massive. But what truly separates his analysis from, say, earlier interpretations? Because for decades, the standard view came straight from his friend Max Brod, didn't it?
It did. And Brod really framed Kafka in theological or existential terms. Robertson consciously throws out that romantic mythology. His approach is rigorous. He combines deep historical context with really deep textual knowledge, and he maintains a critical distance from Brod's personal filter, which is key.
How does he manage that distance?
Crucially, his expertise in German, Czech, and Hebrew allows him to access original cultural and archival documents, things earlier biographers maybe couldn't. So he's not just reading the literature, he's reconstructing the very nuanced, multilingual world Kafka actually lived in.
Ah, okay. So this means Robertson's central idea is that Kafka's works aren't just these isolated psychological outbursts. They're sophisticated, informed responses to the specific political, social, and philosophical anxieties of his time. Is that about right?
Exactly. The book successfully rescues Kafka from that caricature of a man paralyzed by anxiety and replaces it with a portrait of a competent, observant professional who actively participated in Prague's complex social landscape.
So if they aren't just psychological screams, what should we call these stories then? How should we approach them?
Robertson frames the major works as rigorous thought experiments. Gedanken experiment in German. Kafka takes an absurd premise like, you know, transforming onto a beetle or being arrested for some unknown crime, and then explores the consequences. But he does it with this chilling, relentless, and almost dispassionate logic. The real horror isn't always the absurdity itself.
It's how people react to it.
Exactly. It's the way characters and society adapt to it with this utterly business-like seriousness. That's where the deep disturbance lies.
Okay, let's unpack the historical pressure cooker he was living in then. You mentioned Prague.
Yeah.
It was a pretty complicated place.
Oh, absolutely. We have to understand Prague as a trilingual, multicultural city, German, Czech, and with a significant Jewish population. This created this sense of constant friction. And Robertson highlights what you could call Kafka's triple alienation. He was a German speaker.
Right, in a city becoming more Czech nationalist.
Yes. And he was Jewish, but felt detached from the sort of Yiddish Eastern European traditions of his ancestors. He didn't fully belong to any one group.
That status as a permanent outsider.
Yeah.
Wow. That seems like the central engine for his universal themes of detachment and alienation then. It wasn't a choice. It was just his reality.
And this sophisticated contextual approach, it even changes how Robertson views Kafka's most famous source of supposed personal trauma, his father, Hermann. The letter to his father is usually read as, well, pure psychological venting, right? Trauma.
Yeah, the ultimate difficult dad story.
But Robertson contextualizes it differently. He sees it more as a literary exercise, almost. Informed by contemporary philosophical ideas about power and family, it's like a case study.
Wait, so he was using his own father not just as, like, a diary entry subject, but as raw material. A case study for these emerging theories on power dynamics, in families, in society.
Precisely. Hermann Kafka is reevaluated, not simply as a tyrannical parent, though maybe he was difficult, but as a template for those arbitrary, unquestionable authority figures we see everywhere in the fiction, the unreachable judges, the distant castle officials.
That's fascinating. It really reframes it. Still, it's hard to square this image of the engaged analytical writer with the other common narrative, the day job. We usually hear his work at the Workers' Accident Insurance Institute was just soul-crushing drudgery, something he hated.
Yeah, that narrative of soul-crushing drudgery is definitely part of the myth Robertson wants to dismantle. He shows that this job was actually genuine, deep engagement with cutting-edge social reform at the time. Kafka was dealing firsthand with the consequences of industrialization complex laws about industrial accidents, working class conditions, the huge bureaucratic machinery needed to manage modern risk.
I find that almost hard to believe, honestly, given how, well, bleak his fiction often feels.
Mm-hmm.
How can a day job dealing with accident reform actually inform something as dark and strange as the metamorphosis or the trial?
Because it gave him intimate, detailed knowledge of how large and different systems operate, their internal logic, their processes, their impersonality. That practical knowledge, that's the source of the precise social critique embedded in his fiction. It's not just vague angst, it's observed detail. So when we look at The Metamorphosis, written during that intense period, Robertson argues we should read it as a specific, rigorous response to anxieties about commercial life and family economics, not just personal depression.
Right, the famous thought experiment again.
Yeah.
The horror isn't just that he turns into a giant insect.
No. The horror is the pragmatic, the chillingly logical way the family adapts to Gregor's sudden, uselessness as an economic unit, as a provider. Their concern immediately shifts from, how is Gregor, to, oh God, how will we pay the rent? That's the dark humor Robertson highlights, the business-like seriousness applied to this absurd, tragic situation.
Okay, that lands differently. Let's move to the great novels then, starting with A Trial.
Uh-huh.
Robertson cautions against viewing it just as simple prophecy of, say, totalitarianism.
Yes, that's vital. Robertson insists it's primarily a novel about the nature of the law itself, capital L law. An immense self-perpetuating bureaucracy with its own inaccessible internal logic. Joseph K.'s failure isn't that he's guilty. It's his rational, enlightened-style attempt to understand a fundamentally unknowable system.
So he's not struggling against malice or evil, necessarily?
Not directly. He's struggling against systematic indifference. The system just grinds on, following its own rules, regardless of him.
And what about the castle? Where K, the land surveyor, is trying to get legitimacy, trying to belong, seeking contact with this remote authority.
The castle perfectly illustrates the problem of mediated authority. K is constantly thwarted, right? But not usually by the castle itself, which remains abstract, distant, almost mythical. He's blocked by the endless chain of miscommunication, the minor officials, the petty gatekeepers. The castle represents this ultimate power that it's always just, one phone call away, one corridor away, one official away. But never reachable.
Like modern customer service sometimes.
Exactly. Robertson suggests that this reflects post-Habsbury anxieties about finding your place in a fragmented modern social structure. Where is the real power? Who do you talk to?
And those devastating little parables, like Before the Law, they stick with you.
They are magnificent traps, designed perfectly. They force the reader into the same loop of interpretation that frustrates the characters in the stories. They demonstrate the paradoxes of seeking access. Access to systems of meaning or systems of power that seem simultaneously open, anyone can try to enter, and yet permanently closed access is always deferred, always just out of reach.
Okay, so if we pull back from the individual works, what are the core takeaways, the big shifts in understanding Kafka that this perspective gives us?
Well, first, I think we have to completely flip the script on isolation versus engagement. Social integration, not isolation, fueled his genius. His profound fiction emerged from his deep critical engagement with his environment, not despite it. He was processing the world he saw every single day at work and in Prague.
That's huge. Okay, what else?
Second, the insight into historical specificity. These works are not just timeless allegories dropped from the heavens, you know. They were sophisticated responses to very specific contemporary debates. Legal reform, the new science of psychology, modern Jewish identity politics in Prague, they function as rich historical documents in their own right.
So they're grounded in his time and place.
Absolutely. And third, and this is maybe key to appreciating him in a new way, the logic of the absurd and the dark humor. Robertson shows the horror often lies in the cold, systematic indifference of power, not necessarily an act of malevolence. And the humor, it's dark, yes, but it's found in the sheer contrast. the clash between the severity of the crisis, like Gregor turning into a bug, and the often trivial bureaucratic or financial response of those around him.
That focus on dark comedy makes him feel, well, maybe not less bleak, but certainly more complex and weirdly more relatable. Let's share a few key ideas or quotes that really capture Robertson's findings. First, maybe his famous statement on what literature should do.
Right. Kafka famously saw literature as this powerful, almost revolutionary tool. A book must be the axe for the frozen sea inside us. Robertson recontextualizes this. It wasn't just about unlocking individual feeling or angst. It was about literature challenging comfortable social and political assumptions. It was an axe to break up the frozen sea of accepted conventions, social inertia, bureaucratic thinking.
Wow. Okay, and speaking of politics, there's that quote about bureaucracy that feels incredibly prescient.
Oh, it really does. It demonstrates Kafka's foresight, his sharp analysis. Yeah. Every revolution evaporates and leaves behind only the slime of a new bureaucracy. This shows his profound understanding of power structures. He saw that authority, even if momentarily overthrown, tends to reform itself into these indifferent, self-perpetuating systems, the very thing Joseph K. confronts in the trial.
Chillingly accurate sometimes. And finally, we have to remind ourselves about the influence of his friend Max Brod. The Brod effect, maybe.
Yes, we absolutely must acknowledge the paradox there. Max Brod saved Kafka's work from destruction, which is monumental. We owe him that. But at the same time, he also imposed a very specific filter on it, theological, existential, prioritizing Kafka, the prophet of doom, maybe, over Kafka, the sharp historical critic. Robertson's work is largely about peeling back that filter, trying to see the specific, grounded analyst underneath.
Okay, so this is all fascinating literary and historical analysis. But why should the average person listening today care about dissecting an author who died a century ago? How does this historical knowledge translate into practical insight for us living now?
Well, I think the most immediate application is in navigating modern bureaucracy. It sounds obvious, but Kafka's insights are incredibly relevant. He teaches us that large systems, whether it's a government agency, a health insurance provider, or even, like you said, a corporation's technical support, they often operate on their own internal, indifferent logic, a logic that ignores fairness or human emotion as we understand it.
So if I'm stuck in that endless chatbot loop, or on hold forever trying to fix a denied insurance claim. How does Robertson's Kafka advise me? Do I yell? Appeal to their humanity?
Huh, probably not yell. The practical tip derived from this reading is stop demanding empathy from the system itself. It likely doesn't have any. Instead, approach the system by patiently learning its specific internal language and processes. Find the rule book, learn the protocols, understand the procedural steps. You use their own indifferent logic, their own rules, often against them, or at least to navigate them.
That's actually far more actionable than just complaining about how terrible the system is. Okay, what else?
The thought experiment method itself is also a phenomenal tool for enhanced critical thinking. It trains your brain to anticipate flaws, to see downstream consequences. When faced with a new policy, a new technology, a new social trend, say, AI taking over more complex decisions, you take that premise seriously, follow its cold logic rigorously. Ask, okay, if we accept this strange new factor as a given, what are the logical, indifferent, and maybe unintended consequences down the line? You can potentially predict systemic flaws or problems before they become huge.
That's a really powerful way to think. For me, I think the biggest surprise here is realizing that the profound impact of his literature, the stuff that resonates so deeply, came not from isolation or neurosis, but actually from deep critical engagement with his specific historical world, combined, of course, with unmatched literary skill.
Absolutely. Robertson's work fundamentally transforms Kafka, doesn't it? From this sort of prophet of despair into a clear-eyed analyst of the systems around him. And that allows us to appreciate the profound humanity that's actually found in his ability to diagnose those nightmarish scenarios, and even sometimes find the dark, knowing humor within them. He was an outsider, yes, but one who is acutely present and observant of the mechanisms of his world.
And this shift, it lets us read his novels not just as projections of his own inner turmoil, but as these meticulous, almost scientific examinations of the very real pressures of modernity. The rise of bureaucracy, the anxieties of identity, and maybe the terrifying consequences of indifference, both personal and systemic. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.